This is Audible.
The Psychedelic Experience, a manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, by Timothy Leary, Ph.D., Ralph Metzner, Ph.D., and Richard Alpert, Ph.D. Introduction by Daniel Pinchbeck. Narrated by Paul Heitch. Introduction, 2007, Daniel Pinchbeck. It has been 40 years since the heyday of the 1960s and the brief flowering of the psychedelic era that ended abruptly when Woodstock gave way to Altamont. The achievements of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, were obscured by the terrorist acts of the Weathermen, and sensitive Beatles lyrics inspired the homicidal rages of Charles Manson's family. Nobody can say for certain to what extent psychedelic use led to the radical inquiry and eventual degeneration of the 1960s spirit. It was certainly one element in a much larger story. In the wake of the 60s, many commentators from across the political spectrum found it convenient to blame psychedelics for some of the period's destructive excesses. Suppressed, interdicted, and generally reviled, mind-altering substances such as LSD, mescaline, mushrooms, and ayahuasca have not received a serious reconsideration since that time. Today, it is hard for us to imagine that long-ago moment when Ivy League professors, established intellectuals, film stars, famous poets, and millionaires sincerely believed that the exploration of non-ordinary states of consciousness through chemical means could induce a radical transformation of the individual and the society. Within the broader context of this story, The Psychedelic Experience, a manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is both a historical document and an anthropological curiosity. Written by a trio of renegade Harvard psychologists in 1962, The Psychedelic Experience was the first attempt to offer a written guide through the startling disjunctions, visionary vistas, disorienting droops into egolessness, and surges of ego inflation reliably induced by the ingestion of a sizable dose of a hallucinogen. The collaborators have attained legendary status in the intervening decades. Timothy Leary, charismatic ringmaster of the Harvard group, was soon to become the Pied Piper of the acid generation, using the mass media as a pulpit to proclaim his dicey message of turn on, tune in, drop out, before he fell into disgrace and disrepute. Richard Metzner went on to have a long career as a scholarly and meticulous advocate for the visionary experience, writing books such as Ayahuasca, Human Consciousness and the Spirits of Nature, and The Unfolding Self, Varieties of Transformative Experience. Richard Alpert made the archetypal journey to India, where he found his guru, forsook LSD for yoga, and successfully rebranded himself. As Ram Dass, he has guided and inspired several generations of Western seekers. By the time of the writing of The Psychedelic Experience, Leary, Metzner, and Alpert had abandoned the traditional methodologies of the social sciences for the intensive pursuit of mystical revelation and personal liberation. This change in focus happened in an extraordinarily compressed period of time. Leary's first psychedelic trip on psilocybin occurred in Mexico in 1960 as he approached his 40th birthday. Returning to Harvard, he changed the subject of his research from interpersonal communication and what he termed existential transactions to an exploration of the possible uses of psychedelics for transforming personality and behavior. He launched a project in which prisoners were guided through psilocybin sessions to see if this would affect their rate of recidivism. At the same time, he gathered a circle of graduate students and like-minded professors around him in Cambridge, where they explored mushrooms and LSD together on a regular basis. The cult-like euphoria created by this investigation began to alienate the Harvard establishment, ignoring the novelist Aldous Huxley's prudent warnings that the only attitude for a researcher in this ticklish field is that of an anthropologist living in the midst of a tribe of potentially dangerous savages. Leary seemed to revel in defying convention and attracting attention to his antics. His increasingly erratic behavior led to reprimands and eventual dismissal. The Harvard coterie relocated to the Millbrook Mansion in upstate New York, continuing their intellectual inquiry into the liberational potential of psychedelics. The scene was dubbed the Crip Trip by Ken Kesey, who drove his magic bus of merry pranksters from the West Coast to Millbrook for a brief and famously uncomfortable summit. The rediscovery of psychedelics in the late 20th century caused shockwaves because the modern psyche had been cut off from the direct access to revelation formerly possessed by the shaman and seer. Before the explosion of interest in the subject during the 1960s, direct visionary gnosis and shamanic techniques of ecstasy had been exiled and suppressed in the West for many hundreds of years. The witch hunts that took place during the Middle Ages launched a devastating assault on the last vestiges of indigenous shamanism and the orally transmitted knowledge and use of vision-inducing plants throughout Europe. During the era of colonialism, Europeans sought to annihilate the traditional wisdom of those they conquered. Possessed by the hierarchical framework and transcendent ideology of Christianity, the Europeans crusaded against any and all representatives of the archaic worldview that knew second sight, visions, and prophecy to be crucial aspects of reality. With the rise of the modern scientific method, the only form of awareness that was seen as valid was empirical, rational, and materialist. Anything else was grist for romantic poetry or faint fever dreams. As Harvard psychologists, Leary and his cohorts had high status and a role in maintaining the smooth functioning of the American machine. In the 1950s Cold War era, American psychology was biased toward naive behaviorism, prioritizing the objective and observable over the subjective and psychic. It is not surprising that the psychedelic trip, revealing multitudinous levels of awareness and secret domains of psychic activity, would have detonated within this mindset with such tremendous implosive force. "We're all schizophrenics now, and we're in our own institution," Leary proclaimed in the wake of his first mushroom trip. Wisdom, of course, is easier to obtain in hindsight. In hindsight, it is easy to see that it might have been prudent for Leary and his coterie to wait a number of years before proclaiming the psychedelic experience in itself as a fast track to enlightenment, whatever that is. They might have restrained themselves, observing the longer-term effects of psychedelic use on themselves, their work, and their relationships. They might have seen the strategic value in maintaining their Ivy League connection and pedigree, even if it meant radically slowing down their experiments. Unfortunately, the psychologists also had no background to prepare them for their sudden shift into expanded awareness. Previously, their access to altered states had been through alcoholic inebriation, and the binge drinking endemic to 1950s professional life was as contractive as psychedelics were expansive. Their worldviews radically wrenched by a massive ingression of previously unknown psychic intensities, the Harvard psychologists grasped these chemical catalysts as the answer, rather than approaching them with skepticism and proper caution, as tools that, potentially containing hidden dangers, required scrupulous care. The psychedelic experience is a cultural artifact of this early and pivotal time in the historical development of psychedelic use and understanding in the modern West. In their efforts to find a spiritual context for entheogenic exploration, the Harvard trio gravitated to the sacred culture of Tibetan Buddhism, interpreted in the groundbreaking works of Y.I. Evans-Wentz and Lama Govinda. In retrospect, this choice is interesting on several levels. Although Leary had taken mushrooms for the first time in Mexico, he reported feeling that he understood the Mayan civilization for the first time during his trip. They did not create a manual based on indigenous practices or draw any connection to tribal shamanism in North or South America. Instead, they chose to contextualize the hallucinogenic journey in relation to the wisdom tradition of Tibet, which must have seemed far more distant in 1962 than it does today, when many Tibetan lamas have migrated to the United States. The Dalai Lama is a household name, and thousands pursued Tibetan Buddhist practices. Once again, a more cautious attitude might have mitigated the dangers of superficially appropriating the highly developed spiritual technology of a remote civilization. This quick grafting of entheogenic exploration onto Tibetan Buddhism could be seen as reflecting the absorptive ethos and narcissistic emphasis of our American mindset, which tends to see all other cultures and resources as fodder to feed its experience, material desires, and knowledge base. This manual may have helped to create a long-running rift in the spiritual culture of the modern-day West between followers of Buddhism and yoga on one side and advocates of shamanic experimentation on the other. Although many Western Buddhists discovered the validity of expanded states of awareness through early psychedelic journeys, entheogenic use is frowned upon in traditional Buddhism and in modern adaptations of Eastern disciplines. The philosopher Ken Wilber draws a distinction between the experience of temporary states and the development of permanent traits. While psychedelics can allow us to access different levels of awareness, their use does not necessarily compel a transformation that would turn the developmental possibilities glimpsed in those states, such as greater levels of empathy, a wider intellectual scope, a more refined aesthetic and sensuous engagement with the physical world, and so on, into positive character traits. Ego inflation and distorted judgment can be the result. A realistic assessment of the use of psychedelic substances for personal development would reckon with both the positive and negative aspects of short and long-term use, as well as the benefits of participating in shamanic work with an established tradition. We might find that psychedelic use can support a shift from states to traits, but only within a larger framework and proper context for personal development. Throughout the psychedelic experience, we find an emphasis, entirely lacking in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, on the selfish game-involved nature of man, selfish game desire, the return to game reality, the ego game, and so on. While Buddhism recognizes the basic goodness of our essential human nature, obscured by karma, the writers of the manual seemed mired in a puritanical and sin-stained conception of the individual. Apparently, the tripper's nefarious ambitions to succeed in the game worlds of modern life needed to be purged in the hallucinatory fire of the entheogenic encounter. In this respect, and many others, the psychedelic experience overlays a simplistic and moralizing psychological perspective on the subtler and more profound exegesis of an ancient spiritual science found in the original text. As for the value of the psychedelic experience as a tripper's manual, it was certainly used for that purpose by thousands of people during the 60s, and may have provided a helpful reference point for some who would otherwise have plunged into their first journey with no context at all. In retrospect, however, the conjunction of Bardo state experiences and psychedelic plateaus seems more than a bit forced, and the insistence on the desirability of losing the ego almost seems naive. Ego freedom might be a more appropriate goal than ego loss. The ego is our particular lens for perceiving reality, therefore loss of it would be devastating. However, if we could attain freedom from the ego, we could act out of a holistic awareness of our particular perspective in relation to larger social and evolutionary processes. John Lennon, who borrowed a few lines from the manual for a song, "Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream," later told an interviewer, "I got a message on acid that you should destroy your ego, and I did, you know? I was reading that stupid book of Leary's and all that shit. We were going through a whole game that everyone went through, and I destroyed myself. I destroyed my ego, and I didn't believe I could do anything." The psychedelic era of the 1960s could be seen as an attempted mass cultural voyage of shamanic initiation. Because our culture lacked the proper frame of reference and background, as well as elders and wisdom keepers who could guide the process, the effort reached a certain point and then short-circuited. Cultural figures like Leary and Lennon were thrust into the role of psychopomps, although they had not undergone the types of rigorous training demanded of shamanic candidates in traditional cultures. By the end of the 1960s, mechanisms of social repression, such as the Nixon-instituted War on Drugs, which continues today, incarcerating millions of nonviolent users of interdicted substances, had kicked into gear. The movements of personal liberation made permanent changes in Western culture, but the initiatory process remained incomplete. 40 years after the Summer of Love, it is possible that our culture is on the cusp of undergoing a second, much deeper phase of this initiatory journey. As the pioneering psychedelic chemist Alexander Shulgin has pointed out, the idea that the Earth moved around the sun was radical heresy at one time. A century later, it was a commonplace truism. The prospect that the inner exploration of consciousness with psychedelics might be recognized as, in itself, a positive and worthy endeavor is another radical heresy that may be seen as self-evident in the future. Rather than collapsing into anarchy, a civilization that supports the adult individual's right to utilize these chemical catalysts for self-discovery and spiritual communion might advance to a more mature and stable state. Much of the anxiety and negative conditioning around the subject could be dispelled with logical argument based on evidence for the relative safety of psychedelics, especially natural ones, compared to other drugs. The point is not that everyone needs to take psychedelics, but that the minority of people who find themselves compelled to make this exploration could be permitted to do so. There has been a huge evolution in our knowledge and use of psychedelics over the intervening decades. The growing curiosity and increasingly sophisticated knowledge base on the chemical and psychological mechanisms and spiritual value of psychedelics is supported by a cottage industry of books on the subject, ranging from the chemical recipes for mind-altering alkaloids presented in Alexander and Anne Shulgin's Pichal, Phenethylamines I Have Known and Loved, and Tikal, Tryptamines, to Stanislav Grof's groundbreaking works on non-ordinary states of consciousness and the birth of trauma, from Benny Shannon's The Antipodes of the Mind, Charting the Phenomenology of the Ayahuasca Experience, to Andy Lechter's recent Shroom, A Cultural History of the Magic Mushroom, from anthropologist Jeremy Narby's The Cosmic Serpent, to Dr. Rick Strassman's DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and many more. At the same time, various aspects of the psychedelic revelation that were so shocking to the generation coming of age in the 1960s have been seamlessly integrated into our new technologies, scientific paradigms, and pop culture. In August 2004, the English newspaper The Mail on Sunday reported that geneticist Francis Crick was taking low doses of LSD when he discovered the double helix form of the DNA molecule in 1953. Matt Ridley's 2006 biography, Francis Crick, Discoverer of the Genetic Code, also discusses Crick's LSD use. This bit of information, which Crick strenuously suppressed during his life, is only one of many examples of a secret technostic history linking psychedelic use with recent advances in human knowledge. The creation of the personal computer and the internet was apparently fueled by crossover between techies and the psychedelic counterculture. This relationship is the subject of at least one recent book, What the Dormouse Said. The awareness of interconnectivity of consciousness, often induced by psychedelics, has been given visceral form through the continued development of the net and Web 2.0. For the first time since the 1960s, the government and the academy are permitting scientific research into psychedelics after a 40-year break. The multidisciplinary approach to psychedelic studies, MAPS, is one U.S. group that is currently shepherding a number of projects through the tangles of government bureaucracy. MAPS-sponsored studies, currently underway, examine the use of psilocybin to treat obsessive-compulsive disorders, the possible efficacy of MDMA to help terminally ill cancer patients prepare for death, and the use of the West African psychedelic Iboga as a treatment for drug addiction. Unconnected to MAPS, a recent John Hopkins double-blind study essentially replicated experiments from the early 1960s, giving psilocybin and placebos to volunteers who had never experienced a psychedelic before. 60% of the volunteers found their psilocybin sessions to be positive, and in some cases, spiritually transformative. While these results were unsurprising to anyone versed in psychedelic history, the study received surprisingly prominent media attention in the Wall Street Journal, on CNN, and elsewhere. While scientific study of psychedelics picks up again, there is also an increasing openness toward the legally sanctioned use of natural entheogens, God-releasing chemicals, in established religious ritual. In 1993, Congress passed the Emergency Religious Freedom Restoration Act in reaction to a decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court that removed some federal protections from the Native American Church, which consumes the peyote cactus during all-night ceremonies. In 2005, following this new trend, the court ruled in favor of União do Vegetal, a Brazilian religion that uses the visionary potion ayahuasca in its sacrament. Ayahuasca contains the psychedelic dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which is endogenous to the human brain and is found in many plants. União do Vegetal is one of several authorized religions in Brazil that incorporate ayahuasca in their ceremonies and have official government approval as well as UN protection. Outside of the scientific establishment and the religious context, personal experimentation with psychedelics remains popular in various subcultures across the United States. As the archives of the Vault of Arrowhead, www.arrowhead.org, make abundantly clear, there are now many more people exploring a wider range of psychedelic compounds, from natural plants to recently discovered synthetic chemicals, than ever before. While the official interdiction continues in this country, we are in the throes of a global psychedelic renaissance that is, in many ways, far more extensive than that of the 1960s. Arrowhead features trip resorts from individuals or small groups, sometimes taking substances in shamanic ritual, but often for purposes of inner exploration and hedonistic enjoyment. It is possible that the current opening around this long-suppressed area of psychedelic vision foreshadows another bout of intense legal and social repression. However, it is also possible that a more profound, almost subliminal shift is taking place in attitudes toward the use of these substances, whether for personal exploration, shamanic vision, religious rite, or scientific study. In a culture that is awash in prescription chemicals, drugs of abuse, and mood-altering SSRIs, it seems increasingly odd to ban a handful of plant substances and related compounds. Even LSD is closely related to a chemical found in ergot fungus that have been used by human beings for untold thousands of years. If psychedelics are making a resurgence at this time, this may be due to larger social forces. As in the 1960s, our civilization appears to have entered another phase of acute crisis, as well as, perhaps, evolutionary opportunity. To a large extent, the cultural and social movements of the 1960s developed in reaction to the Cold War, which nearly reached a devastating nuclear climax during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. The awareness of humanity's hair-trigger proximity to self-inflicted annihilation inspired individual acts of courage and brilliance, and mass movements for social and personal liberation. It also led to widespread interest in psychedelic exploration as a fast track to self-knowledge and spiritual illumination. Rather than leading to instant enlightenment, the visionary insights, temporary dissolution of ego boundaries, and deconditioning from proscribed social codes often induced by entheogenic explorations helped some people to reevaluate their own role in society at that time. Today, we are faced with an intractable and unpopular war in Iraq that has already continued longer than the U.S. involvement in World War II. A rise in terrorism and a global ecological crisis of terrifying magnitude. Just as the 1960s generation had to confront the militaristic insanity of the Vietnam War and the Cold War, our generation has to reckon with the individual and collective mindset that has brought us to this critical threshold, quickly approaching the point of no return. While it would be the height of silliness to consider psychedelics in themselves as the answer to the massive problems now facing us, they continue to offer some individuals a means for looking at the world from a different vantage point, integrating new levels of insight. When we cast a cold eye on the current planetary situation, we discover that the industrial culture and excessive lifestyle of the affluent West masks an intensifying scarcity of resources that is unsustainable, even in the short term. According to scientists, 25% of all mammalian species will be extinct within the next 30 years. Our oceans are 90% fished out, with the potential for an irreversible collapse of many fisheries. As accelerating climate change leads to an increase in natural disasters, the polar ice caps are melting at rates that exceed predictions, potentially leading to a significant rise in global sea levels, causing coastal flooding. At current rates of deforestation, there will be no tropical forests left on the planet in 40 years. According to many geologists, we are on the verge of peak oil, the highest possible production of oil, after which production must decline, leading to higher prices and potential scarcity of energy in the next decades. While thousands of new, barely tested chemicals and genetically engineered species are introduced to the global environment annually, the human sperm count is declining 1% per year, down 50% over the last half century, due to the spread of compounds such as pesticides and plastics that disrupt the endocrine system. Our efforts to find short-term technological fixes for the problems we create often lead to deeper errors and more dangerous unintended consequences. We are faced with the urgent task of changing the direction of global civilization if we want to avoid biospheric collapse and species burnout. Without romanticizing native cultures, we can recognize that in many cases, their intimate and sacralized relationship to the natural world kept them from overshooting the carrying capacities of their local ecosystems. The modern fixation on abstract, quantifiable, and rational modes of thought has profoundly alienated us from the directly sensorial and mimetic forms of knowing and relating maintained by indigenous cultures, allowing us to treat the natural world as something separate from ourselves. The entheogenic experience can temporarily reconnect the modern individual with lost participatory modes of awareness that may induce a greater sensitivity to his or her physical surroundings, beside raising a psychic periscope into the marginalized realms of mythological archetype and imaginative vision. It is not a question of forfeiting our modern cognition for fuzzy mysticism, but of reintegrating older and more intimate ways of knowing that can help us find a more balanced relationship with the human and non-human world around us. It may seem unlikely that psychedelics could be rehabilitated, but who knows? Profound shifts in consciousness and culture happen in surprising ways, overturning the smug certitudes of academic experts and media commentators. New forms of awareness develop below everyday consciousness, gestating in hidden reaches of the collective psyche, long before they are allowed to be articulated and manifested as new social realities. What was once scandalous and impossible can become acceptable and obvious to a new generation, and doors that long seemed securely padlocked may swing open at the merest touch. As new paradigms of knowledge emerge, breaking through the crust of old habit and received conditioning, change becomes possible and, sometimes, inevitable.